This is a download from the Post-Keynesian Economic Study Group, PKSG. For more information and terms of use, please visit www.postkeynesian.net.
I think you know who I am. I'm Mark Hayes, organiser of this seminar, and this is Victoria Chick, who I am the secretary of the Post-Keynesian Economic Study Group. Vicky is the co-founder of the group. So I owe the existence of my office to her initiative. When was it? 20 years ago. Yes, well.
At least, yeah.
That's right. So it's a great pleasure to have her here tonight. And I feel I'm putting my neck on the block here a bit, but for reasons that the committee, the PKSG committee, has been thinking about how these seminars should be used. And one of the main issues that we want to address is the controversies in post-Keynesian economics. Now, I mean, I know this is in some senses quite well-worn, but we would actually like to try and resolve some of them, perhaps, who knows? And until they go away, or until they are resolved, I think it's going to be very difficult to, in certain respects, to make progress. Anyway, that's the sort of underlying motivation of this paper. I'm going to speak for about 45 minutes. It is a slightly heavy paper.
Terrible.
So I've given you a typescript as well, in case, you know, because I'll take it fairly quickly. But hopefully my talk will clarify what I've written. And then Vicky has very kindly agreed to respond. Take about 25, you know, the usual pattern, about 25 minutes, and then that'll leave a bit of space at the end for your comments. So, although the subject of this seminar is the use and abuse of equilibrium, the paper I've circulated is on the state of short-term expectation. The connection is that Keynes's treatment of expectation is the key to understanding the limits of equilibrium analysis. I find it necessary to offer a critique of post-Keynesian received wisdom on this point, and it turns on the apparently minor question whether Keynes's own exposition involves a tacit assumption that short-term expectations are fulfilled. The reading in of this tacit assumption has had profound consequences, nothing short, in my opinion, of derailing Keynes's project from the outset. We are in a mess where mainstream economists wrongly understand the general theory as the economics of rigidity, while post-Keynesians have largely abandoned competitive equilibrium theory. So the structure of my talk is as follows. First, I consider how and why the consensus that Keynes makes this tacit assumption about short-term expectations has emerged. Then I shall apply two tests of the validity of reading in this assumption in terms of consistency, first with the text, and second with the logical framework of the general theory. Then I consider briefly why the tacit assumption is unnecessary. My conclusion is that the tacit assumption is both unwarranted and unnecessary, and that astonishingly, Keynes and Lucas have something in common. The important corollary is that equilibrium theory is important and useful, that Keynes was a master of it, but its legitimate domain is restricted to the present moment alone. There is a pathway here for post-Keynesian thought finally to succeed in Keynes's objective of redefining, not abandoning, mainstream economics. Now, the consensus is undoubtedly that Keynes does assume in GT Chapter 3 that short-term expectations are fulfilled, although he does not state this in so many words. And here are a few quotes for you to read. I won't read them out. One from Victoria Chick. One from Kevin Hoover. And one from Olivier Alain, I think his name is. The origins of the claim appear to lie in Keynes's 1937 lecture notes. Again, a quote here. And in the celebrated 1976 article by Jan Kregel. Kregel christens a model in which short-term expectations are always fulfilled the model of static equilibrium, and distinguishes this from the stationary model that Keynes relies on for the first 18 chapters of the general theory, unquote, and from the model of shifting equilibrium. We'll consider these models in detail later. The immediate point to note is that neither Keynes nor Kregel suggest that Keynes actually made the assumption in the general theory itself, tacitly or otherwise, that short-term expectations are always fulfilled. Kregel is careful to distinguish the static from the stationary model and sees the static model only in the 1937 lecture notes, not in the general theory itself. So why have so many writers felt it necessary to read this tacit assumption into GT chapter 3? And the nub of the matter is here in Keynes's definition of effective demand. This is probably familiar, but this is part of it. So what does Keynes mean by this description of adjustment to equilibrium, and how does it relate to expectation? There can be no doubt that Keynes is here concerned with expectation, expected proceeds and expected profits. Furthermore, aggregate demand is defined in terms of the expectations of entrepreneurs, who are treated as a group, rather than in terms of the expenditure of consumers and investors. Furthermore, since production takes time, as Keynes emphasizes, how do expectations relate to realized results? And what exactly motivates entrepreneurs to change their employment decisions? The consensus holds that the process of adjustment must be a dynamic process of convergence over time, motivated by the disappointment of expectations, so that equilibrium is reached and defined by the fulfillment of expectations. In grappling with the fact that Keynes specifies aggregate demand in terms of the expectations of entrepreneurs, rather than the expenditure of consumers and investors, writers have postulated the need for two aggregate demand functions, one in terms of entrepreneurial expectations and the other in terms of expenditure. And there is some tension within the literature over which of the two demand functions defines the point of effective demand. And the absence of the expenditure function in Keynes's chapter 3 text is taken as evidence that Keynes conflates the two, which is only possible if entrepreneurial expectations are fulfilled. Therefore, it seems this must be his tacit assumption.
Doesn't he define it both ways in chapter 3?
No. A further point to note at once is that the idea of convergence of expectations to equilibrium is associated with the Swedish approach, as in quotes, which predated Keynes and was expounded by Olin in the November 1936 Marshall Lectures, and which the main object of Keynes's 1937 lectures, titled Ex Post Ex Ante, was to repudiate. And there's a quote from that. Unfortunately, these lecture notes were not published until 1973, which is one reason why Kregel 1976 is of particular importance, as the beginning of a discussion about effective demand that appeared to have concluded with Amadeo's 1989 book until its recent re-emergence. Since Kregel 1976 has been widely recognised as the seminal work on the treatment of short-term expectation in the general theory, I take this article as my starting point for considering the consistency of a claim that Keynes makes this tacit assumption with the text of the general theory itself. So Kregel's article is now cited less for its principal purpose than for its definition of the three models of static, stationary, and shifting equilibrium. Keynes himself referred to a division between the theory of stationary equilibrium and the theory of shifting equilibrium, meaning by the latter, the theory of a system in which changing views about the future are capable of influencing the present situation. In Kregel's static model, the state of expectation is given and expectations are always realised. The system moves instantly to the point of effective demand. This model reflects the proposition in Keynes's 1937 lecture notes and corresponds to the tacit assumption. Kregel's stationary model allows for individual expectations to be disappointed without affecting the underlying given state of general expectations. Disappointed entrepreneurs then revise their expectations until by trial and error they hit on the point of effective demand. Finally, in Kregel's shifting model, the state of general expectation itself can change, both independently and as a result of individual disappointments. And this model describes an economy, quotes, chasing an ever-changing equilibrium. It need never catch it. Unquote. Now, although Kregel's analytical key to Keynes's method is elegant and has undoubtedly been persuasive, his reading of the text is open to serious objections. These can be summarised as the usage of the terms static and stationary, the meaning of period and term, the introduction of a distinction between individual and general expectations, the difference between a change in expectation and disappointment of expectation, the correspondence of production with short-term, not long-term, expectation, and the implication that employment will normally be in disequilibrium. It's quite a long list. Kregel's choice of the term static equilibrium to denote a state in which expectations are fulfilled is unfortunate. Static equilibrium refers only to a point in time, without necessarily implying anything about future outcomes. It's true that Valrasian general equilibrium theory reduces the future to the present, so that static becomes associated with timeless, yet the general theory is also, for the most part, static in its method of equilibrium analysis, and anything but timeless. Indeed, the term stationary would be a better description of a state in which short-term expectations are always fulfilled. But Kregel uses the term for a different purpose, namely to denote a given and constant state of expectation. Again, this usage is unsatisfactory, for the only place where Keynes assumes a constant state of expectation is where he considers the convergence of employment to a long-period equilibrium position, an exercise in disequilibrium dynamics, and therefore hardly an example of stationarity. Kregel draws a distinction between particular individual short-period expectations and the effect of the state of general long-period expectations. This is not a distinction made by Keynes, who writes as follows. Kregel elides the concept of period and term. In fairness, Keynes himself sometimes used the terms interchangeably, yet in the general theory itself, he was remarkably consistent in using period as an adjective to refer to the type of equilibrium, short period involving the adjustment of employment of existing resources, and long period involving the adjustment of the capital equipment. And he used the word term to refer to the two different types of expectation, short term, long term. The distinction's important. For example, in the section about convergence to long period employment, to which I just referred, Keynes refers to a constant existing state of expectation. Since Keynes defines employment as based on short-term expectation, in this section, Keynes is describing the long period adjustment, that is, including changes in the capital equipment as well as in employment, to a new state of short-term expectation. So long-period employment relates to the short and not the long-term. And to use the words interchangeably in this context creates confusion. Long-period adjustment might take a matter of months or a year or so, sufficient time to produce new capital goods or scrap old equipment, while the long-term, over which new equipment yields its fruit, could be many years. Consider the difference between the time to construct a new building and its useful life. This distinction drawn by Craigle between particular individual and general expectations does not exist for Keynes. Keynes consistently refers to the state of expectation, encompassing both short and long-term expectation, and both individual and general, with short-term expectation being in part a function of long-term expectation. Now, Craigle's static model certainly generates such a shared state of expectation, and this may be part of the attraction of imposing this model as a reading of GT Chapter 3. However, the stationary model, which Craigle attributes to the general theory itself, does not contain a singular shared state of expectation, but has room for the disappointment of individual expectations, while general expectations remain constant. And I'll come back to this later in relation to the logical problems it creates. The target of Craigle's paper is quite rightly the Swedish emphasis on ex ante and ex post. It is therefore ironic that even though he shows through the device of the static model that disappointment of expectations has nothing to do with the principle of effective demand, it is ironic that Craigle still places a great deal of emphasis on the disappointment of short-term expectation, whether in the shifting model, where disappointment of individual expectations leads to change in the general expectation, or in the stationary model, where disappointment does not lead to such change. By contrast, Keynes concerns himself mainly with a change in expectations rather than with any disappointment consequent upon such change. The passage on convergence I referred to earlier begins with a statement, "Now in general, a change in expectations, whether short-term or long-term, will only produce its full effect on employment over a considerable period. The dynamic process of long-period adjustment of the capital equipment, described in various passages in the general theory, takes place in a given state of expectation after a change in expectation has already taken place, with its consequent windfall, gains and losses. Disappointment of expectations, and I quote Keynes, cannot affect the actions of entrepreneurs, but merely directs a de facto windfall of wealth into the laps of the lucky ones." Unquote. Craigle states that Keynes made the assumption of constant long-period expectations in the static and stationary models, thereby separating out long-term expectation from the state of expectation as a whole, and allowing short-term expectation to be disappointed. And he continues by stating that the relative importance of long and short period expectations are thus given varying weight in the general theory, and at certain points in the book, Keynes does not make it clear what he's assuming about each. And so on. The confusion here, apart from the interchange of period and term once again, is with the possibility that realised results disappoint short-term expectations, yet the state of short-term expectation, not long-period expectations, remains unchanged. Keynes writes, "The actually realised results of the production and sale of output will only be relevant to employment insofar as they cause a modification of subsequent, I would put in, short-term expectations." And clearly this leaves open the possibility that such expectations remain unchanged. Kregel gives the example of a producer of electrical power as follows. The answer to the question that he poses is clearly negative, but it's the wrong question. The question should be, if on any given day demand for electricity falls 5% below expectation, should our electrical entrepreneur reduce the next day's employment? The answer is probably not. One day's shortfall is unlikely to affect the state of expectation relevant to employment, i.e., the state of short-term expectation. Finally, in Kregel's stationary and shifting equilibrium models, employment is more likely than not to be in disequilibrium at any time. In these models, the principle of effective demand does not determine employment at any time, unless we make the tacit assumption, but only the equilibrium position towards which employment would tend if individual expectations were stable enough to converge. By contrast, Keynes himself claims to offer a theory of actual employment at any time, based on the equilibrium of supply and demand, such that today's employment can be correctly described as governed by today's expectations. Yet he himself refers to this as a theory of shifting equilibrium. In summary, although Kregel himself does not claim that Keynes made the tacit assumption, Kregel's hermeneutic key has been pivotal in encouraging later authors, including Vicky, I think, to reach that conclusion. So let me now turn to what she has made of it. In Macroeconomics After Keynes, Vicky argues that for the purposes of exposition, Keynes must have made the tacit assumption and explicitly relates this to Kregel's static model. And this is her objection. As justification for stating that Keynes adopted in the early chapters the assumption that firms' forecasts of aggregate demand were broadly correct, she quotes in a footnote the following sentence from Keynes. However, note that Keynes continues as here. The causation runs from realised result to expectation, not the other way. Expectations conform to realised results, not realized results to expectations. There's nothing here to require that expectations based on realized results will in fact be fulfilled. It is true that there is no detailed discussion of the dynamics of expectations formation, but why is such a discussion necessary? It is not necessary if employment at any time is determined by effective demand, i.e. by the state of expectation itself. Vicky indeed recognises that for Keynes, employment at any time is determined by the point of effective demand, but, contrary to Kregel, distinguishes this from the equilibrium point corresponding to actual demand. In her words, effective demand is an unfortunate term, for it really refers to the output that will be supplied. In general, there is no assurance that it will also be demanded. She therefore accepts the likelihood of unemployment disequilibrium and indeed goes further. Vicky views this imprecision with equanimity, and in her later methodological works has extended this to make a virtue of necessary compromise and formal vagueness, in contrast, with the sterility of what she calls equilibrium theory. This leaves me, as a theorist who is concerned with both purity and relevance, uncomfortable with the idea that Keynes was unable to construct tight theory, especially as that is exactly what he claims to have done. Yet Vicky's conclusion follows relentlessly from the premises of the received understanding of the general theory, which does not accept Keynes's claim to offer a theory of employment at any time, nor consider how the principle of effective demand might itself be a theory of the formation of expectations as equilibrium values. So, returning to the structure of my argument, the next task is to test the logic of the received wisdom, both internally and against the logical framework of the general theory. The key questions on which the argument turns are the existence, uniqueness, and stability of the state of general expectation in Kregel's framework. So first, existence. As noted above, Keynes constantly refers to the state of expectation of entrepreneurs. What can this mean? Since expectations are necessarily formed in the minds of individual entrepreneurs, and why should they agree? Kregel's solution is to make the distinction between individual and general expectation not made by Keynes, where individual expectation can be disappointed, while general expectation persists. In whose mind, then, does the general expectation exist? And secondly, how and why should individuals fall into line? Now, in Keynes's framework, a short-term expectation corresponds to an expected price. A state of expectation can in turn then be associated with a set of short-term expectations or expected prices for the final output of each Marshallian industry. This understanding of short-term expectation differs markedly from that of Kregel and Vicky, who envisage firms estimating demand curves, whether at the industry or aggregate level. Indeed, this point connects directly with another disputed question, the assumptions about market structure in the general theory. Here we need concentrate, for present purposes, only on the distinction made by Vicky in a 1992 paper between perfect competition and polypoly, her term for competition between many small firms under uncertainty. Vicky rejects the price-taking of the received notion of perfect competition because, in her view, it imposes the assumption of perfect foresight. She insists that under uncertainty, all firms, even small ones, inevitably set prices. She asks, how can firms take prices from markets which lie in the future? The short answer, of course, is that they cannot. Her solution is to postulate that firms set prices initially by making hypotheses about demand, constructing hypothetical demand curves as opposed to either expected or actual demand curves. A set of hypothetical demand curves traces out the firm's supply curve, and the firm then chooses the particular point on the supply curve which corresponds to its expectation of demand. In the case of Polypoly, firms ignore strategic interdependence and base their expectation of demand, i.e. demand price, on their estimate of the price that clears expected supply and demand in the market as a whole. And this analysis can be generalized to the cases of monopoly and oligopoly. The problem with, or virtue of, depending on where you stand, this construction is simply that there is no reason why firms should arrive at the same expectations. It's therefore quite possible that individual expectations are disappointed, as both Craigle and Vicky insist. But it leaves us without the singular shared state of expectation referred to by Keynes. Any given level of employment may be associated with a myriad of different states of expectation, represented by all the different permutations of individual expectations that would lead firms in aggregate to offer that particular level of employment. Any hope of determinacy, then, lies only in the convergence of individual expectations to a general expectation which is correct in the sense that it corresponds uniquely to any given level of employment. So, uniqueness. Craigle defines his general long-period expectations to correspond to Keynes's long-period employment as the endpoint of a process of convergence of individual expectations. Thus, the state of general expectations represents a set of expectations which may not in fact exist in the minds of any entrepreneur, but is nevertheless an equilibrium position towards which individual expectations will tend by a process of trial and error. And Vicky's 1983 book contains a diagram which describes this convergence of expected demand, that's DE, to the actual demand, D, and of employment to its unique equilibrium value, B, as distinct, in Vicky's view, from the moving point of effective demand depicted by point A. And Craigle notes that convergence requires the assumption of independence between individual and general expectations. In Vicky's diagram, the centre of attraction is provided by the equilibrium of actual demand with supply conditions. So it seems that contra Keynes, it is not really expectation that determines output and employment, except in the individual daily disequilibrium which Craigle and Vicky regard as the normal state of affairs. The state of general expectations is itself determined by the expenditure decisions of consumers and investors. The most one can claim for entrepreneurial expectation as an independent causal force is that the expenditure decisions of investors are determined by the state of long-term expectation. It follows that the state of short-term expectation is of no fundamental consequence. And indeed, it is argued, Keynes himself accepts this view, because after GT Chapter 5, aggregate demand is defined in terms of expenditure rather than entrepreneurial expectations. Yet there is a fatal ambiguity in this interpretation of Keynes's long-period employment, as corresponding to an equilibrium state of general expectation reached by a process of trial and error. Any such process of discovery must take place over time. If the end point is to be defined by the equilibrium between expenditure demand and the conditions of supply, the aggregate supply curve must not shift. At the same time, we are assuming that investment is taking place, creating new capital goods, and therefore continuously changing the conditions of supply, the very point wrongly made, as it happens, by Pigou and Kaletsky against Keynes. Thus a further indeterminacy is introduced. If by chance individual expectations converge quickly, the state of general expectation will take one set of values. If convergence is more prolonged, the state of general expectation will take another. In fact, there is a multitude of possible equilibrium positions which are not independent of the time it takes to find them. Thus we find ourselves immediately, even in what Kregel defines as the model of stationary equilibrium, with the very problem that Kregel defines by the model of shifting equilibrium, in which the behavioural functions are constantly shifting and equilibrium need never be reached. So we began with general expectation as something unknown to any individual, and now it appears that there can be an indefinite number of states, an indefinite number, I should say, of states of general expectation, since each depends on how long it takes for individuals to discover it. So the third difficulty is in the area of stability. It could be argued that it's not important that the state of general expectation is unique. What matters for the coherence of the principle of effective demand is that individual expectations can be expected to converge upon the state of general expectation, whatever it may be at any given time. Yet even this claim cannot be taken for granted. Vicky's diagram takes as self-evident the existence of a well-behaved function mapping excess demand onto changes in expected prices. There's an extensive Valrasian literature concerned with precisely questions of stability and expectations formation, which I will not burden you with, but the gist of it is that stability is highly vulnerable to discontinuous changes. The important distinction must be made between convergence from a position of simple disequilibrium per se and convergence from a position of short period equilibrium to a position of long period equilibrium. Both Kregel and the Valrasians are concerned with the former, extremely difficult case. The latter is the Marshallian case, which is analytically far more tractable and for which stability is much more assured. And it's this Marshallian case to which Keynes's long period employment refers. The convergence of employment to a long period position, that is, in Keynes's sense, a state where the capital equipment has adjusted to the state of expectation, if a given state of expectation persists. In Keynes's case, it's not individual expectations, but the capital stock which is adjusting along the dynamic traverse. It therefore appears that Kregel's state of general expectation neither exists in the minds of individual entrepreneurs, nor can the dynamics of expectations formation be relied upon to bring individual expectations into line with the general state. There could not be a greater contrast with Keynes's singular state of expectation. If we follow Kregel, we can no longer claim, with Keynes, to explain why, in any given circumstances, employment is what it is. It is all a matter of individual expectations, which, as we have shown, have no firm anchor. In the final analysis, the whole thing falls apart. And Keynes's shifting equilibrium becomes Kregel's shifting disequilibrium, in which we chase shadows through darkness. To conclude, my work in this talk has been critical. My predicament is that of the inventor of a mousetrap. He must first prove that mice exist, that there is a problem which requires solution. I've offered my solution elsewhere in my book, articles, and last year's talks to this seminar, which you can download if you wish. And briefly, that solution is an understanding of the principle of effective demand as being in itself a theory of the formation of the state of short-term expectation as a matrix or set of equilibrium expected prices at any point in time. The system moves instantly to equilibrium, as in Kregel's static model. But at no point does this construction involve the fulfillment of expectations. Disappointment of short-term expectations may or may not shift the expectations matrix, but these disappointments are likely to be trivial compared to the effect of sudden shifts in the states of long-term expectation or of liquidity preference. The formation of expectations is always a matter for the present moment, and it is not necessary to tangle with insoluble problems of expectations formation under dynamic conditions of unpredictable discontinuity. So let me finally draw this discussion back to the subject of the use and abuse of equilibrium. The claim that Keynes makes a tacit assumption that short-term expectations are fulfilled is unwarranted and unnecessary. Furthermore, the interpretive framework that demands that assumption has inadvertently undermined Keynes's claim to offer a determinate theory of employment at any time, and helped to lead post-Keynesian economists into abandoning competitive equilibrium theory altogether rather than identifying its limits. I regard that as a serious loss, which must be rectified if Keynes's ambition to redefine mainstream economics is ever to be fulfilled. There's an unlikely consensus between Joan Robinson and Robert Lucas that if we are to do equilibrium theory, we must assume that we are always in equilibrium. New classical theory clings to full employment as the appropriate conception of equilibrium, where Keynes offers, in the principle of effective demand, the concept of equilibrium relevant to the monetary production economy. Where new classical theory invokes rational expectations in order to assure equilibrium, Keynes limits rational expectations, what he calls judicious foresight, to the state of short-term expectation, leaving the state of long-term expectation as an independent variable. Nevertheless, there is a point of contact here between the methods of Keynes and Lucas which ought to permit the start of a debate. But no debate is possible if Keynes's treatment of time is thought, in line with the current post-Keynesian received wisdom, to remove any possibility of determinacy from the theory of employment under competition. And to read the general theory as a theory of employment as an equilibrium value at any time does not vindicate equilibrium theory as the sole or even primary tool of economics. On the contrary, competitive equilibrium analysis must be confined to its legitimate domain, the present moment. Today's short-term expectations and employment may be equilibrium values, but they can shift discontinuously between today and tomorrow, and no mathematics can bridge that abyss. We need different tools to explain phenomena which involve progress through time, such as economic growth, fluctuations, and crises. But Keynes's distinction between the theory of stationary equilibrium and the theory of shifting equilibrium remains the necessary starting point. Thank you. So over to Vicky. It'll be fine then.
It'll be fine then, all right. Well, I'm very pleased that some of you have the courage to turn out for such an arcane discussion, because it is arcane. But I think it is also an important discussion. I must apologize. I'm at a very serious disadvantage here because the light level is so low I can't really see my nose. I think that Mark and I differ in some respects that are even different from the many that he's already articulated. I want first to put the whole thing in some kind of general context, which Mark has also done. He emphasizes that his conception of the general theory is a static equilibrium construction, and yet I know perfectly well from his book that he has a flow conception, a flow through time of production and arrival of goods at market and so on, which belies that emphasis. My own emphasis is very much in terms of a stream of events which Keynes tries to capture or model in a variety of ways within the same book, some of which are static in a technical sense, but where the underlying process always involves, to my mind, some kind of dynamics. And to me, that conception is very important, even in the case of production, which is the first element of the theory which Keynes tackles in chapters 3 and 5, because it underlines the fact that producers are uncertain of their markets when they commit themselves to the hiring of labor and the production of a certain level of output. I'll elaborate on these points in a minute. The other thing that I think distinguishes the approach of the different approaches of the two of us is what we want to protect. Clearly, Mark, in his peroration, indicates that it's competitive equilibrium, which is dear to his heart and which he wants to protect, and which in his book he goes to great lengths to protect by introducing wholesalers who stand between the market and producers, so producers are free of the anxiety of not knowing the extent of their market. The wholesalers carry the can on this, carry all the burden of market uncertainty. And my concern is to preserve uncertainty, and uncertainty permeates the general theory. It appears everywhere, and it appears in the theory of production and employment as much as anything else, in my view. Now, these are the general matters that I think permeate this whole discussion. But let me start out by clarifying one point of absolute agreement between me and Mark, and two possible sources of disagreement, at least one of which opens up a possibility of further understanding between us. The point on which we agree is that expectations of demand and supply conditions together determine output and employment in Keynes's chapter 3. There's no question about that whatsoever in my mind. Keynes in chapter 3 wobbles between saying expected demand and actual demand, and this is where I took the assumption that the distinction between expected and actual demand was blurred in the general theory. And the other place I took it from was chapter 5, which discusses the disequilibrium situation, as I would call it, the situation in which expectations are not fulfilled, and what do firms do then? That is the subject of chapter 5. So I saw chapter 3, which is a very settled kind of exposition, and very simple, even conforming to classical assumptions of having a supply curve and a demand curve and a determinate outcome, as one in which the complications of expectations not being fulfilled were put off to a further chapter, that is to say, chapter 5. Now, Andy Dennis ran a reading group on Keynes not very long ago, and in that reading group he argued that the frame of reference of chapter 3 should be one of hypothetical outcomes. If the level of expected demand is this and the supply curve is that, then the principle of effective demand is here, and that determines output and employment. No particular need, therefore, to discuss whether by aggregate demand Keynes meant expected aggregate demand or actual aggregate demand, and no need for the tacit assumption. I find this argument very persuasive. But in any case, as I say, there is a strong agreement between us that expected demand and supply conditions determine output and employment. But I don't call that equilibrium, and Mark does. And that brings up the areas of potential disagreement. A disagreement, perhaps, in our usage of the term equilibrium, which has a couple of dimensions. First of all, I think equilibrium is a much misused phrase and much too generally used phrase since the advent of modern economics, that is to say, neoclassical as opposed to classical economics. In classical economics, equilibrium had a particular meaning. In neoclassical economics, it is identified with the solution of simultaneous sets of equations, or equation systems in a much more general, sense. As a solution of a mathematical problem, equilibrium has no particular claim as a word which tells us anything. I think it should be reserved for something more than simply a mathematical solution. And I assume it means a state of rest, a state where the variables repeat, if you like, or keep their values. Jeff, I know, has abandoned the word equilibrium because it's so fraught and only uses the word rest state now.
That's my natural position.
And so there I think we differ, because I believe that Mark is sometimes using equilibrium to mean optimization. An equilibrium position for firms is one in which they choose that position on their aggregate supply curve, given their expectation of demand or expectation of price, if you prefer. We can argue about that, which will maximize their profits. Equilibrium simply means a profit-maximizing position. I reserve the term equilibrium for something more systemic, either something which happens in a market where there are two groups of people whose plans mesh, or a situation in which one group's plans may be fulfilled and another's frustrated by virtue of the situation they are in. The second, of course, applies to the labour market in Keynes's economics, in which labour is perfectly free to push for higher wages if that is the only way that additional labour is forthcoming, but cannot insist either on the real wage that they get or the amount of employment that they get at less than that full employment situation. So they are rendered powerless by their situation. Their powerlessness means that the equilibrium is created by the profit-maximizing plans of firms in connection with their powerlessness. There's no countervailing force. I think that the confusion between equilibrium meaning a point of rest and equilibrium as a mathematical solution manifests itself in a further confusion between what is determinate or what it means to have something determined and equilibrium. I think Marx's whole concern with convergence between expectations and actual outcomes is directed towards getting what he thinks of as a solution, which I think I can give you chapter and verse, but I can't see his paper now and his light, so I can't really do it, to obtain a determinate solution. For me, the labour market in chapter 3 is completely determined by the expectations of firms and their supply conditions. But because their expectations could be wrong and that may cause them to reconsider their position in future, I don't call it an equilibrium. And I think a great deal of the tension that Mark has highlighted here has to do with that confusion. Indulge me, I want to read you quite a lot of a couple of pages of a paper I wrote in 1996. It was published in 1998, if I can, that is, in the slides. For Keynes, the composition of the general theory was a long struggle to escape from habitual modes of thought and expression. He invites his readers to join him in that struggle. All the evidence, however, is that our minds are so filled with contrary thoughts and notions that we cannot catch the clues Keynes was trying to throw us. Contemporary habits of thought are even further from Keynes's conception than the habits of Keynes's predecessors and contemporaries, and they are vigorously defended as the only correct way to think. This chapter examines equilibrium in the general theory and portrays Keynes's concept as misinterpreted by both the mainstream and the neo-Ricardians. Well, forget the neo-Ricardians for the moment.
Yeah, poor old chaps.
Poor old chaps, misguided fellas. But some interpreters of Keynes would argue that equilibrium is a neoclassical concept not worthy of study. I believe that equilibrium serves two purposes in the general theory. It is an organizing principle, and it serves a didactic purpose in demonstrating that involuntary unemployment could persist, there being no endogenous forces leading to its elimination. As Craigle, 1983, not the same paper, has reminded us, equilibrium was not a central concept in the classical economics. They had, however, a concept of a stationary state where the system replicates itself. It is therefore a position of rest of a systemic kind, which deserves to be called equilibrium. The marginalist revolution both elevated equilibrium to a new prominence in economic method and restricted the term to the equality of supply and demand. Since supply and demand represent firms' maximizations of profit and individuals' maximization of utility, this equilibrium, today known as market clearing, is simultaneously a position of optimal choice. Hicks comments on the subject, quote, "There is an equilibrium when all individuals are choosing the quantities to produce and consume which they prefer. To a conception of equilibrium that is of this type, we must hold fast." I always think of this rather as the protest of a drowning man, but he's clearly emotionally involved in this.
Poor old John.
Matters became much worse with the mathematization of economics. This formalized the system as a series of markets, each described by a demand function and a supply function. If the equations are static, they admit of only one solution, if the equations are well behaved. There is no other set of values for which the specified system is internally consistent. Therefore, the solution set is called equilibrium, and the equilibrium ensures coordination of a set of plans which represent optimal choices. But there can be no meaning to disequilibrium in such a system. And this is the whole point of my bringing all this up. Conflict between this concept and Keynes's conception is a major source of the difficulty of understanding Keynes. It is the source of statements that unemployment equilibrium is an impossibility or an illogicality, and that rather the general theory should be interpreted as a theory of unemployment disequilibrium, possibly adding the idea that adjustment to equilibrium is quite slow. That's Leon Herbert, you recognize it. Berchelli notes that the static concept of equilibrium is vacuous. Equilibrium only has meaning in a dynamic system where disequilibrium is possible. Part of the job of Keynesian restoration, therefore, must be the rehabilitation of Keynes's dynamic system and his concepts of equilibrium within that system. In sharp contrast to modern usage, Keynes does not look to equilibrium to provide solution values for a model, but rather, in the Treatise on Money, seeks, and I quote, "a method which is useful in describing not merely the characteristics of static equilibrium, but also those of disequilibrium, and to discover the dynamical laws governing the passage of a monetary system from one position of equilibrium to another." And there's a further passage from the treatise which makes the same point, which is in too small print for me to see. Some believe the general theory to be a retrograde step, seeing it as a return to statics after the dynamics of the treatise. But I believe this is a misperception, although the general theory begins with a theory which has been described as static, and I quote here Pragel 76. Even that model is dynamic in its underlying structure. Indeed, without the role of time, the problem of uncertainty, understood by all close followers of Keynes to be fundamental to the general theory, has no meaning. So that, I think, sets out pretty clearly what I think is the framework in which equilibrium has to be considered, and why I think Chapter 5 belongs with Chapter 3 in talking about the role of expected and actual demand. Keynes quite rightly says in Chapter 5 that a disappointment of expectation will only change firms' behavior if it changes their expectation. Yes, that's absolutely right, because Mark is right. Every period, it is expectations of the future which govern the determination of output and employment. I don't dispute that at all. And I don't need the tacit assumption for the determination of output and employment, but I do need it if I'm going to call chapter 3 an equilibrium chapter. That's the distinction. That's where we fall apart. I did write an article repudiating my former self. I had a little comment in the Journal of Post-Keynesian Economics commenting on Hicks, commenting on ISLM, in which I made this point, but without spelling it out, that equilibrium and determination were not the same, and I didn't realize until later that for Hicks they were the same, and so we were talking at completely cross purposes. And so I wrote in Her, the Australian journal, an article making that point clear and making it explicit and saying, I'm sorry, I missed Hicks's point completely, but then also he missed mine. I didn't put it quite like that. But I think Mark is probably close to Hicks on this. It's a supposition, but it's something that we have to thrash out, and where I think there is a chance of coming to a closer understanding of what's involved between us in evaluating chapter 3. Now, as I say, if that's where the problem lies, a lot of the rest of it can be resolved, this question of convergence and so on. I'm going to leave the question of Kregel's paper because, I mean, I brought it with me with some faint hope of reading it on the train or something, but I don't remember it the way Mark presents it, so I'm not really in a very good position to defend him.
The general theory?
What?
Has anyone brought the general theory?
I brought chapter 3.
Ah, good.
If you wish to consult it, you may. yes, I couldn't believe you didn't have either that or MAK under your arm, but still, or Kregel. I've got Kregel. There are a few points which I think might deserve a moment or two. One concerns this question of individual variation and expectation. Aggregation always causes problems, and Mark refers to a literature in which that is the case, where a set of individual expectations may not add up to the same general expectation, or where a general expectation is consistent with several configurations of individual expectations. I take the same view that I take of Marshall's notion of industry equilibrium. In industry equilibrium, it is not the case that all firms are maximizing their profits. Some are making losses and leaving, others are making supernormal profits, and so on. The population of firms in an industry equilibrium is changing, but the industry as a whole is sort of stable, and that's enough for me. I mean, if it isn't precise enough for Mark, well, I'm going to leave the sleepless nights to him. I realize that moving from microeconomics to macroeconomics is a terrible problem, insoluble problem, and that to do it effectively you need to make compromises, and to sort of hand wave on this issue is enough for me. I'm perfectly happy with individual firms making different assumptions about the position of aggregate demand as it affects them, in the same way that I'm perfectly happy I said, with Marshall's concept of industry equilibrium, and if Keynes calls it the general state of expectation, this to me can mean a concatenation of expectations held by individuals in exactly the same way that Keynes's phrase, the interest rate, means all the interest rates. I don't know if this is a serious issue or not, but I think it's probably not so central. And in the case of my use of polypoly rather than perfect competition, polypoly, incidentally, was a phrase I later learned after I thought I'd invented it for myself. I later learned was used by Richard Kahn in his Economics of the Short Period. And yes, and he has in the Short Period book a rather similar treatment of polypoly to the one that I developed in response to these problems. Now, what is at issue here between perfect competition and polypoly? It is the preservation of uncertainty. As I started off at the beginning, what I want to preserve is uncertain future prospects governing the motion of the economy in the general theory, whether it's uncertainty about investment prospects or production prospects or liquidity or any of these things in which Keynes discusses uncertainty. Now, in the typical exposition of perfect competition as it is done today, not as it's done in Marshall, which Mark has written splendidly about, you have the following proposition. We have a market, supply and demand. From this market, we derive an equilibrium price here, there, and that feeds back to firms. They take that price, and given their supply configuration, they will produce accordingly. Okay? Perfectly straightforward. Well, Mark rather makes out that my assertion that this is an equilibrium system is a kind of eccentric view only held by me. I forget what his phrase is, and I can't find it, but anyway, you will find it. I think it's perfectly clear. I mean, the market is already known in order for the firms to take the prices that determine the production that feeds the market. What is that if it isn't a closed system which can only exist in equilibrium? It only has one solution, right? It's a static equilibrium. It has no possibility of disequilibrium in that kind of framework, and no possibility of uncertainty. Now, a more sophisticated version might say, well, and this is what I do in part in the polypoly article, firms build up their supply functions in using hypothetical prices. If the price were this, I would produce that. If the price were something else, I'd produce another quantity, and so on. And these can be aggregated up to the market, right? But where does the demand come from? The demand has to come from outside, and if the market hasn't opened yet, it is, by definition, unknown, and there are no prices to take. That is my point. So what I've asked people to do in writing that article is something which a lot of people find extremely difficult to do, which is to unbundle the notion of the small firm from the notion of price taking. They don't have to go together, and they can't go together if you want to preserve uncertainty and the notion of producing for a market which lies in the future. So that's my take on Mark's comments on perfect competition, you can see that I'm perfectly happy with small firms. If I weren't, all the equations in the general theory would have to go because they're all based on the small firm, because you can't do them for anything else. But I do want very much to preserve uncertainty, and therefore the one element that I can't accept in the perfectly competitive framework is price taking. I had something else to say about that. I forget what it was.
You've got 10 minutes.
Well, I won't use them all. No, I think I'm going to leave it there, actually. Other things will come up in discussion, because there are thousands of little points where I could split hairs with you, you know. But the main point, I think, is that we're using the term equilibrium differently. I'm not wedded to the tacit assumption, except when I want to use the word equilibrium. But when I want to talk about determination of output and employment, I don't need it, and I'm perfectly happy to do without it. I suppose the only other point to mention, she said as an afterthought, is that one of the things that Kregel is so valuable for is that he makes it perfectly clear that there's more than one model in the general theory. You've concentrated on Chapter 3, and I've concentrated in my remarks on Chapter 3. Chapter 3 and 5, they have to go together as far as I'm concerned. But some of your text actually makes it sound as if this applies to the general theory taken as a whole. Hoover's, the quotation from Hoover read as if it applied to the general theory as a whole. At least Kregel and I are confining our tacit assumption, if you like, to Chapter 3. Hoover smears it all over the place, and a lot of people do that. So I think that we want to be very careful to realize that our remarks concern a very small part of a very large and complex book. They don't necessarily apply to the book as a whole. And there was a little bit of a false impression, I think, generated with some of your rhetoric, that it might be absolutely fundamental to the understanding of the totality of the book. Chapters 3 and 5 are a small part of a complex system in which assumptions are made and then dropped, made and then dropped. So the model is changing constantly throughout the book. But I will stop there and hope that the discussion will clarify matters further.